Hi, my name is Judy, and I'm an alcoholic. And I, you know, I've been on the circuit lately. It seems I've been speaking, you know. And so if anybody who has been at those other meetings and just feels like cutting out, I wouldn't, it wouldn't bother me, you know. Because sometimes I went to a meeting, it's okay, Grant. And sometimes I go to a meeting, but I always hear something different from the speaker every time I do. And just before I came here, I was talking to a friend of mine who's not an alcoholic or in the program. We're very, very close, and her husband and she and I, and we work together in the stock market and whatever. And I told her I was bringing her this perfume over because I don't like perfume on me anyway. I just don't like it. And she said, yeah, she said, I got to show you something. She said, I won something last night. I'm saying, oh, my God, what did you win, a car? And then I realized that that lottery was like $48 million or something, you know. And I said, well, what did you win? And she said, never mind, I have to show it to you. So, like, my mind's running wild for her because it couldn't happen to a better person if she did win something, no matter what it was, you know. And we've always been friends for a long, long time. I'm not going to go into much of a drunkalog, they call them. Obviously, I drank enough to get here. I drank enough to get 10 people here. And I started drinking very young. I don't know really when my first drink was, but I would say somewhere around 12 or 13. And I was always in and out of reform schools as a kid, you know. So I, to all the rest of the family, I was known as the wild one. But I was a bit wild, but I came from a very violent family, you know. My mother was, she was on her own with four girls and, you know, working. And I was born in 1939. So you can, isn't that amazing? And it's 2000 and whatever. I guess I'm going to die soon. And, you know, that was unheard of in those days. You know, a woman going to work on her own and taking care of these children with no support from a husband. And, and she was an alcoholic, my mom. So, you know, I have sisters that have been in the program for 100 years, two sisters, and they can't seem to forgive, you know. One of my sisters is in New York and the other one is here, and they really go on and really trash her, you know. And I said, my God, how could you be in a program 30 years, especially a program like we have, we're so fortunate to have, and not be able to forgive and see why these things happened, you know. And I mean, it was really treacherous. You didn't know what you were going to get hit with when you walked through the door, you know. And or by whom, really, you know. But, you know, that's the way it was. People today call it dysfunctional homes, and those days we called it Irish Catholic, you know. And my mother was a Presbyterian. So that's the worst part. But if you married a Catholic, you had to bring your kids up Catholic, and blah, 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 you know. And but I was a bit of a problem. I was very rebellious. I hated authority like everybody else, hated school. And I still think of school, and I see kids that hate it, and I figure I try to encourage them, but I just don't blame them. I really hated it, nuns and all this religion. And I've become a bit now like Bill Maher, you know, or Bill Maher, is that how you say his name? And I listen to him, and I figure, oh, you know, he really makes sense. He's almost like my higher power now. Not really, but you know, a lot of things that they taught me in school, I mean, are so ridiculous. Sick, you know. People lived in a whale and all this stuff, you know. Anyway, really, anybody that believes that, I mean, if you're, you know, I'm sorry if you're Roman Catholic, but I mean, I just can't figure that out anyway. But, like I said, I was very rebellious, got in a lot of trouble, was in and out of reform schools. But I remember one time when I was out, and I was very young, I was marking boards for a broker on St. James Street, or St. Jacques, as they call it now. And that was like the Wall Street of Montreal. And I was just marking boards for the summer, and I remember losing that job for being drunk. And I don't know how old I was. I upped my age to get in. And it was in the Royal Bank building downtown, and we used to hide a Mickey behind the radiator. For the Americans, a Mickey is a pint. And we'd go in there, and I got fired from that job for being drunk. You know, I kept falling off the thing where you had to put the numbers up, you know. And that's the first drunk I really remember. The one I don't want to forget is my last, because if I forget my last drunk, I haven't had it. That's the way I feel, you know. And anyway, like I said, I had no education, and I don't know when I don't even think I got into high school. No, I didn't. And I was really, you know, like I said, uneducated. And I started hanging out uptown at an early age around the Esquire Show Bar. Anywhere there was music, I was there. And it's still one of my greatest loves. And one night we just all decided to move to New York. And we were really quite young. I can't put the ages together because when I look at it all now, I figure, my God, I should be like 80 for what I packed in. Well, I almost am. Come to think of it, and packing all the stuff I did in these. Well, I came into AA when I was 34, and the stuff that I got into up until the age 34 was unbelievable. My drinking started here, but most of my drinking was done in New York, in Manhattan, in Washington, Miami, wherever, you know. But home base was New York. And I was never a social drinker. I was always a nasty drunk. I had no ambitions in life. Of course, in those days, women didn't have much choice. You either were sat in a typing pool where men threw paper at you. And I saw that one day, and I said, that will never happen to me. And they're all sitting there, these women, and these men would come by and throw paper at them. I said, oh, my God, you know. And I think I was born before my time or something. And because I knew that I didn't want that, and I didn't, you know, you weren't married by the time you were 19, you were an oddball. And I can remember my mother telling me I was going to be an old maid, and I said, well, I don't want to be like, I don't like that. I don't like, I have a very hard time even today making commitments, you know, but marriage to me was just a real scam, you know. And because my three sisters got married young and had children, and I said, oh, my God, I never seen more miserable people in my life. And that's what women did in those days. They got pregnant so they could get married and out of the house. No matter who the guy was, he had to marry you, you know. Even if it was Shrek, you know, didn't matter. Christ. So I said, well, I don't think I'm going to go that route. So I ended up in Manhattan, and I ended up at 125th and 7th Avenue. I don't know how old I was, really. I was in my teens somewhere. And here I was in Harlem. I think we had one black man in my neighborhood, you know. And I was like, oh, my God, I was overwhelmed, you know. And I said, this is really something. But there I was. I had no fear. We have no fear, right? And we hitchhiked down there. This girl and I don't know whatever happened to her. I think she died. And I had met this musician in Montreal at the old Forum. And I was very, very young. And in those days, when they had a rock show at the Forum, they had all the doo-woppers, you know. They were all there, you know. And I remember this guy. I don't know how I got to meet him. And he said to me, if you ever get to New York, look me up. Well, they all, you know, musicians are musicians. I was married to one, so I know. And I shouldn't say that. I shouldn't generalize because I'm sure there's some good people. There's some good men out there. And but the ones I knew. So anyway, I figured, oh, well, he told me he lived at the Teresa Hotel, which is now Clinton's office. That's some fancy building now. And so I looked him up. Well, the guy was terrified. Just terrified. Here's this young little white girl in the middle of Harlem, and he just didn't know what to do. He said, I think you better phone your father and tell him, you know, where you are. So I did. And I didn't really know my father very well because he didn't like me. And I was supposed to be a boy. And my father said, you got there, you'll find your way back. So I figured, oh, bugger you, boy. So I stayed there, and there was a boxer, an older boxer, his Sugar Ray was his name, not Leonard, the older one. And he and his wife took me in. So I was raised partially with a black family. And it was just wonderful. You know, that was really, really wonderful. And I stayed uptown for a long, long time until I got older. But I learned all the games. I learned all the games of the street. And the only thing that was important to me in life, I thought, because I used to daydream as a child, you know. I used to wish somebody would kidnap me and take me away from all this violence. And the only thing I thought would ever make me happy was money, material things, and, you know, all the things, the minks, the diamonds, and everything. And I thought this from a very young age. I must have listened to my mother, you know. And so I learned all the games. I used to run numbers, and I was a numbers banker for a while. And I used to walk around with brown bags full of money, you know. I don't know if I had a purse even, but I had a lot. I was making all this money. And I learned a lot of things. I hung around Birdland, the old jazz club. And I was listening to some of those old jazz. I was watching a movie on Charlie Parker, who was a heroin addict, the other night. And I figured, oh, my God, how old could I have been, you know? No wonder they were nervous, you know? But I was looking for that money, and that was the most important thing. So I got involved in the music industry, and I hung around there for a long time. But my main ambition in life was women were always taken care of by men in those days because women didn't work unless they did, you know, typed, I guess. And I was always taken care of. Well, I made sure of that, you know, because I was very materialistic. And I'd almost run it down in Bradstreet on somebody before I would even date them, you know. And anyway, I hooked up with this Greek fellow for quite some time. And it was funny because the same thing happened to me when I got sober. And he was a very nice guy, very wealthy, lived in the best building, which was in Murray Hill at the time. I just moved in shoe by shoe, you know, little by little. And I remember one day going into the club, and he loved to drink, and he had credit cards. I thought, oh, my God, this is magic, you know, credit cards. I remember the first card was the Everything card in New York. And he said, don't take that literally, because, I mean, I hit the street like a madwoman with that credit card, you know. And I stayed with him for quite some time. And I'm shoe by shoe, and he walked in the morning, and he walked in his closet, and he said, oh, my God, I'm married. You know, and he was really kind of a confirmed bachelor at the time. And but that was fine, you know. And we stayed together for quite a while. And but I, you know, it's funny, when we're drinking. And I mean, I drank from the day one. I'm not going to go through every drink, like I said. I was always under the influence of alcohol, morning, noon, and night. If there was a drink, I was there for sure. And I remember one night he told me, you know, he said, I'm not really a well man. And I thought, oh, Christ, here comes the other. The shoe's going to fall now. And my whole fairy tale, you know, go and my beautiful home. Everything was mine. Had nothing to do with him anymore. You see, I took over. And we'd order our liquor from the liquor store at night, and they'd send the bill at the end of the month. Can you imagine? And he liked to drink at home. I didn't. I was a bar drinker. I was always out bebopping around, you know. And I said, well, what's wrong with you? And he said, I'm an alcoholic. And I said, oh, for God's sake. I said, so am I, you know. I said, cheers. And so what? You know, I never had any idea that the alcoholic that we see on Skid Row and sitting in parks and, you know, sitting in their own urine and whatever, they don't start drinking there. But that's where I ended up. I wasn't exactly in the park. I ended up on welfare in Montreal. But that's exactly where it took me. I got in more damn trouble in New York, and then the Greeks started going to rehab. Or not rehab, in New York. He used to go into, Roosevelt Hospital all the time. They had a dry out ward there or something. And then he'd come home and he'd have a sponsor, and I said, oh my God, this is all I need. And he said, you know, and he never said anything to me too much about my drinking. And he said, you know, Judy, he said, I think it'd be a good idea maybe if you get a job. I said, oh my God, a job. You know, how tacky is that? What kind of tacky man is this? He wants me to have a job. So anyway, what he meant was volunteer in the hospital. He was very willing to take care of me, you know. And so I got a job on the west side next to local 802 Musicians Union as a barmaid. Well, then, you know, as Don Henley said, this is where it all began. And I'll tell you, for a while it was fun. All my drinking wasn't garbage. You know, I mean, I did have some good times, especially at Charlie's on the west side. And it was amazing. Like, we had a room in the back of our bar where it was a rehearsal hall, and Marvin Gaye and everybody came there on Wednesdays, which was Union Day, and they would rehearse, you know. So naturally, I hooked up with this guitar player, and because I knew the Greek was giving up, and he was getting sober, and the more sober he got, the more drunk I got. And he brought these two guys home from rehab. One is he was going to keep him as like a houseboy or something. I don't know what the hell he was doing. And the other one robbed my jewelry, you know. So I figured, nice guys in AA, you know. You bring them home, they rob my goddamn jewelry, you know. But anyway, that poor man, I remember seeing him after on the street. And I said, how are you doing? Because I didn't know then that it was him that robbed it. And he said, I'm struggling along, you know, just had a coffee. I said, what the hell you want to drink coffee for? I got the key to the bar. Come with me, you know. And you know that man died on Skid Row with no legs. And I just hope that it wasn't my drink that put him there, you know. And anyway, eventually the Greek and I broke up, and I hooked up with this guitar player and went on the road and embarrassed him all over the country. And he was quite well known, and he said, listen, I can't take this. I can't take you on the road. He said, one time at the JFK Center in Washington, we're all downstairs and they're all getting ready to rehearse and blah, blah, blah. And I closed the trunk on his hand. And everybody got hysterical. I said, oh, for Christ's sake. I said, you people are always hysterical. I was drunk, of course. And here I am in this long gown and just, you know, real slob. And I said, what's the big deal? It was a mistake. They said, he's a guitar player. You know, it took me years to figure that out. I think I was in AA before I could figure that out, you know. And a lot of my life drinking, I could see the messages where people were trying to give me. I didn't get it. I just didn't get it. You know, nothing wrong with me. Nothing wrong with me. So Eric and I stayed together a long time. And I went on the road a few times. And eventually he came home and I was all black and blue and all beat up. Somebody had thrown me through a jukebox. And I didn't remember. And he came in the middle of the night. He was famous for doing that. Popping at home by, you know, by surprise. And he told me, he said, if I ever find you with somebody else, he said, I don't care if it's 30 years from now, I'll find you and kill you. I said, oh God. So I remember he was at the forum with somebody, and he phoned me, and I didn't go. I said, he's here to kill me. I was already in AA by then, you know. I said, no, I'm not going down there. And I really loved the guy. I said, but no, I don't want to die. But he will kill me. You know, he's found something out. You know how paranoid we are, right? I wasn't paranoid. It was true. Anyway, we were on the West Coast. He sent me back. And he said he was going to buy a home in the Valley. And he would rather stay in California and love me from there than to stay in New York and watch me kill myself. Well, I didn't get that at all. So with no one supporting me and nobody taking care of me, and I had enough to drink because I was a barmaid, I quickly hit Skid Row, you know. And, you know, if you have someone that's walked out on your life right now, or a lover or whatever, and, you know, you're pining and whatever, it might be the best thing that ever happened. It took me a long time to figure that out, but it was the best thing that ever happened to me. Because with the Greek gone and Eric gone, I strictly, I quickly hit the skids. I had one friend left, and he put me in a hotel on 55th between Broadway and 8th, which is not exactly, I don't know now, but it was a horrible place. I hear they tore it down. And, there was cockroaches. I remember one night waking up with a litter of cats in my bed, and, it was just awful. You know, I remember setting the place on fire, and the only friend I had left, really, was this blind man who lived in the same place, and he had a dog, and the poor dog, he had to lead us all over Manhattan, and I'd be hanging on to Eddie, you know. Of course, Eddie was a man, and I'd run in and lock my door, and he'd be knocking at the door to get in, right? He figured he was going to get lucky. And he said, let me in, you know. And I remember seeing the guys on the street, you know, over the oil cans, warming their hands, the drug addicts. And they used to come and help me across the street. And I say, see, everybody talks about drug addicts. Look how nice they are. They're helping me across the street. Well, yeah, exactly. You know, I was one of them, right? I really didn't have a big issue with drugs. I remember Eric telling me, he would leave me a bag of cocaine when he'd go on the road, and I didn't like cocaine because I tried it, it made me too nervous. Thank God. And he, you know, so I would be in the drawer when he'd come home, and he'd roll all these joints, and they'd be all rolled for me. I mean, how nice, eh? And not that wasn't for me either, because it made me too tired. And I'd get in a lot of trouble if I smoked and I drank. I did my little share of smoking then, but it wasn't my drug of choice at all. And, he'd come home and the coke would still be there, but I'd still be all beat up and a mess. And I sold his guitars for a bar tab and sold a lot of his instruments, you know. And he'd pop into town by surprise. And I remember one barmaid trying to move this amplifier down the bar with her foot because he walked in the front door. She was more terrified than I was. I said, who would kill somebody over a guitar? She said, a guitar player. So I said, no fear when we drink, eh? So I quickly, like I said, ended up in a Skid Row place on West 55th Street, you know. And people stayed away from me. I no longer bathed. I no longer did my hair because I no longer had any money. I'd lost a job as a barmaid. And so I would just go in the bar early in the morning and somebody would always send you a beer, you know. And but I noticed that people would sit beside me and they move along because I could smell myself. So I guess they had to move along too because they were saying, ooh, you know, this is pretty heavy. And eventually people just stayed away from me. And this one man that I knew and I hated, and the poor soul, I mean, he was so good to me. He got me back up here to Montreal, you know. And I continued to drink in Montreal, and my mom was here. And when she saw me, like, she just about died. I came home, I must have been the first bag lady, you know. And because I used to always come home with the T. Anthony luggage and Saks Fifth Avenue and all the bullshit, you know, flaunting everything, you know. And looking at my peasant sisters with their children, you know. How awful. And my mother just burst into tears when she saw me. I was about 160 pounds. And she didn't like me coming home in mink coats at 18 either. Because, I mean, that, you know, where'd an 18-year-old get a mink coat, you know. Only one way to get them, eh? And from the mink man. My mother would say, where'd you get that coat? I'd say, from the mink man, you know. And she would say, you better save some of that money while you're young, she said. She knew what was happening. And she said, but when she saw me for that last time, she just broke into tears, you know. And she was sick and ill and fragile. And she had inherited some money from a man at work. And my mother never had very much for herself because she clothes four girls, and I had figure skating. I had all kinds of stuff. It's such a confusing life I had as a child. You know, you had black and blue legs, and you had to go test for something in skating. And, oh, my God, it was really confusing. And anyway, now my mom was dying, and she used to cry and say, don't leave me. I'd say, just buy vodka, and don't worry about it, you know. And I was so awful to her. And this is the one thing that I always want to remember in my life. I was so terrible to that woman. And, you know, after what she'd been through, and, you know, she knew why I was being nasty. I reminded her of everything she ever did to me. And I made her last days on earth a living hell. You know, and she died before I was able to make amends. She committed suicide. And I often think she committed suicide because of the way we treated her, not very nicely, you know. And if we were drinking together, it was fine, but she was too sick to drink, and it was awful. And that's one thing I don't ever, ever in my life want to forget. Because I know all I have to do is pick up one drink, and I'll become that animal within 24 hours. I can just the same animal, you know. And God forbid, you know, it's the first drink I've got to stay away from. And that's, I've been in the program a number of years, and I'm no safer than anybody else that's been in a week. I'm one drink away from a drunk like anyone else, or whatever your drug of choice is. I've opened my mind to that because in AA we always had singleness of purpose and blah, blah, blah. So I was always kind of a follower, you know, and I said, oh yeah, singleness of purpose, the drug addicts are ruining the program, and blah, blah, blah. Look, there's nobody at this meeting. Well, there's nobody at the meetings are smaller now because everybody's dead, you know. And I talked to some of the old people, and I said, you know, I said, we become old hags and old crabby people now, you know. And I said, we have no tolerance, you know, and we're up here speaking. Our tolerance is zero. We're knocking people that are on drugs. We're not knocking them, but they're talking about the singleness of purpose, which I'm sure it is, that is, you know, part of the AA program. But I do want you to know that if there's anybody in this room or any other room that has any kind of problem, I don't care what it is, that I'm open and I'm available to them, you know? And because I wouldn't want to ever leave a meeting without giving somebody some kind of hope. And it's a new generation today. I mean, if I'm going to be 70, there's guys in the program 90. And I said, it's a whole new generation, you know? You have to accept it, you know? And or at least accept the kids that are coming in and show them that we care about them, you know. They put on this big old-timers meeting every May, and people are blah, 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 well, that guy's this and that guy's that. You know what? If you're in these rooms, it's not by mistake, you know. So whatever that guy is, he is, and God bless him. At least he's here trying to help. And, like, I want people to know that I'm open to whatever your problem is, you can talk to me about it, you know. And I might not understand it all, but I'm certainly willing to see you through and listen and help you as much as I can. My life today, since I've been in AA, is totally amazing. As I said, I have no education. I had no education. Whatever education I got was from copying other people. And I remember I knew this lady on Park Avenue. She said, Judy, always read the social column so that if anybody takes you to 21, you'll know what they're talking about and you can get by on that. I got by on that for quite a while. You know, they thought I was quite social until I had the 10th drink. I wasn't too social. I was ushered out of there quite a few times, you know. And I came into AA I had been to AA meetings. My first AA meeting was in jail in Miami Beach, or Miami proper. And then I only went because there was only one floor of women and the rest were men. So I figured, well, you know, I may as well go and then we'll see all the guys and we'll get cookies, you know. I'll go to the AA meeting. I used to go in the lineup and everything just to get cookies, you know. I'm glad nobody picked me up. And anyway, I had this big romance going in jail with the guy. He was a trustee with the kites going back and forth, you know, these letters. And then he escaped and I got in all kinds of trouble. And they kept deporting me. They deported me 3 times. And thank God, I tell you, miracles happen in AA. I was on my sponsor's husband's boat. And we'd already crossed the U.S. water thing. And he said, this man's a congressman or a senator or something. And I said, oh, yeah. I said, don't tell him, you know. And he said, he's going to fix up everything for you at the border. And this was before 9/11. And God, if he didn't do it, eh? This guy went to the border. It took a while. And he got my name out of the computer. And all my record was cleared. I got my record clear here through some cops that were in the program. And, geez, you should see the certificate you get. It's like McGill. You think I'd graduated McGill. If it didn't say a pardon, I'd frame it, you know. And things, you know, right at the first AA meetings, like I said, were in jail. And then, because I didn't think there was anything wrong. I never realized, had I not been drinking, I wouldn't be in jail. Or I wouldn't have got caught or whatever. And anyway, where am I now? Oh, yeah, I'm back in Montreal now, and in AA, I had a boyfriend, and then I moved out towards Montreal West because I was drinking in a bar at Gerward and Sherbrooke, and I was getting in all kinds of trouble, and I had this dog. I didn't know what kind of dog it was. Somebody gave me it in an elevator. Oh, what a mess I was, and I had this long black hair. I was like this, filthy dirty, as I described. I was in New York, and anyway, so I started... This guy stopped by my house one day and he said, I was showing some pictures of me in an album in Miami Beach. He said, I understand, probably weren't a bad looking broad in your day. He said, but there's no way that's you. So what do? I phoned the Greek and I said, you better tell this guy who I am, you know. And here I am on welfare, right? I mean, I'm quite the number. And the guy left and the Greek kept me on the phone. And till this day, I don't know who... called AA. I think he did from New York. And the thing was that they called me back that night and I refused to go to a meeting because I said I don't go out without my dog. And she said, that's fine, bring your dog. So, you know, and I see a lot of places now and they say, get the dog out of the meeting. And it makes me so mad because it wasn't for that dog and bringing my dog, I would have never went, you know. But it was really meant to be and I believe that God led me up that street. And it was the open door on Tuesday. It used to be on Grand Boulevard. And I went there, and it was nothing like the meetings I had been to in New York with the Greek. And all these nice ladies were there in their, you know, little dresses. I thought everybody was old. I thought I was dynamite, right? I mean, dynamite was the smell. And anyway, I left there, and a fellow came with me, and I said to him, you know, I said, for some reason, I said, I don't think I'm ever going to drink again. And it's an amazing thing. I know it's a day at a time, but up until tonight, that was the day of my last drink, February 12th, 74. And I guess I was ready. I was ready for me. Before, I was going for the Greek, or I was going for other reasons. And I was ready, and I guess my higher power, which I didn't know I had at the time, I always believed in God, though. And I guess he figured she suffered enough. Because I really do believe we're chosen. I really believe that, because I think in all of the world there's 3 million AA members. I mean, how many, Christ, is that? That's a quarter of the people that live in Manhattan. You know what I mean? So I really feel that, for me anyway, that I was chosen. And I'm not a religious person, but I'm very spiritual. As a result of coming to this program, I ended up in the stock market. Some man took a chance, and a very big chance, and somebody said they were going to put a woman for the first time on the trading floor, and they said, take her. And Christ, I didn't want a job. I wanted to lie in the sun. You know, I was still on welfare. I was getting used to that, you know. And I had slimmed down and in a few months, and I was looking better. And the welfare guy kept coming by. And I figured, oh, my God, he's checking on me. Well, the guy was hitting on me, but I didn't get it, you know. And anyway, the guy came. And I'll tell you how naive I was about anything, about life or how it worked. He said, can you come for an interview? And I said, where do you live? Where do you live? I said. He said, where do I live? And I said, yeah. And he said, I live in Dollard. I said, well, I live in NDG, so you just stop by here on your way home for the interview. And he said, oh. okay, you know. So he comes with all these papers because I'm going to be the option trader, right? I don't know from nothing. I don't know an eighth from a quarter. And he threatened, you know, I have somebody else in mind. But I got the job, and I had to take the trading course, which I cheated right through because I'm a person that I could do. I can't read things because I still don't retain a lot, you know. And I can't study. I get, like, over-anxious, and I have to be perfect, right? So I cheated through the whole thing, and I admitted that to him, and I got my trading papers. And I really never knew how to trade. I always liked answering the phones better and giving the directions to the other traders. So basically that's what I did. But what the amazing thing is that I stayed there for 27 years. I got the company watch. And, you know, like, who expected this from me? You know, my mom wasn't here, and very hard to make amends to somebody who isn't here, but there are ways. There have been people put in my life since, elderly women that I've looked after, and I feel that way. I've made amends somehow to my mom, and she knows, you know, that I'm on the right track. And I retired from there just after 9/11. I remember I was on the phone with a guy in New York, and oh my God, you know, like he just disappeared, you know. And I had several friends in those towers. Yeah, I mean, that was, ooh, God. Anyway, I retired from there in 2001 with the watch and the whole nine yards, right? And I was 61 at the time, I think, or 62, I don't know. And I forget now what, and they gave me this big package, which most of it I owed to Holt Renfrew, because God forbid I should shop at Walmart, you know. Oh no, got to be Holt's, right? Well, I owed Holt's my life. So they took up all my package, and I had a little bit left, took a year off, and now I'm 69 years old, and I've started my own little business. I've become a caregiver for the elderly, and I just love it. And I also take care of dogs. And when people go to Florida, I move in their house and take care of their dogs so they don't have to go to a vet or in a kennel or things. And I'm having a ball. Like right now, I'm up in Saint Laurent with two dogs. Oh my God, these dogs are like quadriplegic, so they're going to die any minute. And I've been, oh God, please don't die before I get home. And I'm trying to get here tonight, and there's six cats at the door waiting to be fed. I don't know who's who, you know. But my life today is wonderful. And, you know, to start something new at my age and succeed at it, I mean, I'm not making a bundle of money, but it sure supplements, you know, what I have coming in. And I'm able to get to my meetings, and I'm able to be there for people today. I was always a taker, and I'm not a taker at all anymore. I can't take. I don't even like receiving gifts. I feel awkward. I would rather give, you know, and that's what I try to do in this program, is give the hope, you know, and I really believe I'm a true miracle, you know. If this was in a movie, I mean, nobody would believe it, you know, and so my life today is like completely normal, and when I leave here, I'm going to go see my friends that apparently won the lottery, I think, last night. She called me and she said, Judy, you got to come by. She said, I got to show you what happened to me last night. I want some money. I said, oh my God, you know. So I'm so grateful for this program. And like I said, if you haven't got anything out of my message tonight, that I literally went to Skid Row and through this program and the steps and the big book and a good sponsor. See, in the old days, we didn't jump into the steps. We stopped and smelled the flowers for a year. I went to meetings every day, three meetings a day for a year. And I couldn't have possibly done anything like that. I think I would have, it just wouldn't have worked. I couldn't understand it anyway. And the steps are there to be done, but I don't believe there's a big hurry about it, you know. Is like stop and smell the roses, you know, your first year, and You know, you calm down and you look around and everything was marvelous. I thought Westmount Park was the most beautiful thing I ever saw, and I lived right by Central Park, you know. But you miss everything when we're drinking. We absolutely miss everything. So I want to thank you for asking me here tonight. And if I haven't helped anyone, there's a lot of meetings in Montreal. And I'm sure you'll find, you know, the speaker that tells your story. But I do hope I have helped somebody. I know I've helped myself. Thank you.